This special edition of The Cinema Show was first broadcast on Christmas Day 2015 on Monocle 24. The Cinema Show, in association with Mubi. Sweet smell of gingerbread is in the air, and we've got our mulled wine in hand. It's Christmas Day here at Midori House, and we're sitting back to discuss what makes a Christmas classic. Coming up, it's today's eternal festive favourite. So why weren't audiences of the 1940s so impressed by Frank Capra's crowning glory, It's a Wonderful Life? Plus, we'll revisit the suburban dream of 1950s America, the stunning 1955 classic All That Heaven Allows. Plus, meet me in St. Louis, Christmas with Barbara Stanwyck, and even a word from Santa himself. A stocking full of festive treats coming up on this special Christmas Day edition of The Cinema Show with Mubi, your culture guide to the world of cinema on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House on this Christmas Day here in London. I'm joined today by someone whose voice will likely be quite familiar to regular Monocle 24 listeners. He's usually reporting from the wonderful Australian city of Melbourne, but it's all just a bit too warm and sunny over there this time of year. So he's spending Christmas here in chilly London. Stephen A. Russell, welcome to The Cinema Show.
Great to be here, Ben, and it's wonderful to be half the planet away for this festive season.
Well, of course, as my voice will hint at, I'm Australian myself, so I couldn't agree more. Now, when I asked you for your favourite Christmas movie, you didn't suggest It's a Wonderful Life. You didn't even suggest Meet Me in St. Louis or even the well-trodden Love Actually. I'm not surprised that you didn't suggest that one. All of which we'll discuss a little bit later. Your suggestion was a little more twisted.
Yeah, you know, I have to admit that this time, every single year, I rewatch that great Joe Dante-directed classic, Gremlins. And while that might seem a little twisted, you know, looking at little devils running around, I think there is something to be said for the dark undercurrent of many of these Christmas films, actually, Ben.
We are going to get onto that, actually. It's a very interesting point, the darkness that can permeate a lot of Christmas movies. But of course, a Christmas movie is more than just a film that takes place at Christmas time, isn't it? There's something to be said about what's being represented on the screen, what's being communicated, and the values that are really at the core of the movie itself.
Absolutely. It's a bit of a morality play, the Christmas film, really, when it comes down to it. And I think there is something aspirational about good news stories and good people winning out and bad people being shown up.
That does run through a lot of the films, but there's also the feeling that comes out of It's a Wonderful Life, particularly, that someone can be remade. You know, you can come back from something that has really almost just destroyed your soul.
Yeah, absolutely. People get to the dark moment, but they're brought through it with love and friendship and family. And, you know, these are all kind of core Christmas beliefs.
When I gave you the list of films that would consider Christmas classics, you came back and said, what are you, a Christmas dork or something? I suspect that we've both got different ideas on what makes a Christmas classic. Give me your take.
I would say that perhaps your tolerance for schmaltz is just a tiny bit higher than mine. But look, for me, a Christmas film is a feel-good film. And what makes a good Christmas film wouldn't necessarily be what you think makes a great film. And you're right, it is about the feel. They don't have to be layered in snow and full of, you know, Christmas trees. It kind of is just that sort of feel-good story and a certain spirit in the air. And I think actually, when you look at it that way, your films are quite great.
Now, let's consider it's Christmas Day. You've got a whole bunch of people over at your house. You've just eaten probably way, way, way too much. What are the kinds of films that you would sit down and watch with just a whole crowd of different people from different backgrounds with different tastes in films? You want something that's a crowd pleaser.
Yeah, I think elements of pleasantness, like it doesn't need to be too challenging. But at the same time, that's where a lot of these Christmas films are quite clever, because they do pootle along, but many of them have these deep messages underneath them about, you know, redemption, about love, about being the best person that you can be. But at the end of the day, you don't want it hammered over your head. You want to be able to be kind of semi-snoozing and wake up when the kiss happens at the end and feel good about that.
Now, of course, the cinema show is presented in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. And to celebrate Christmas this year, MUBI is screening the ultimate festive favourite, It's a Wonderful Life. Stephen, we'll discuss that film in detail a little later in the show. First, though, one observation that I made when I looked at the films we'd selected to chat about today, there was one thing that really stood out, and that is that they're all from around the 1940s and the 1950s, and they're all in middle-class America. What do you think it is about this era of American filmmaking that makes it so appealing at this time of year?
It's a bit Stepford Wives. There's this kind of fantastical belief of what Christmas is and what it represents. That suburban America where everyone's white and happy and, you know, that's kind of at the very core of it. And that's why films like It's a Wonderful Life are held up, you know, as incredible examples.
There is that feeling that it is essentially something unreal. But I think that is quite important when we talk about festive films because they need to present you with something that is aspirational. You're going to watch something that takes you into a different world, a hopeful world, something that is nice and beautiful. And that is something that Hollywood does so well. And there's perhaps no greater or more visually stunning example of that than 1955's All That Heaven Allows.
I didn't know they were your trees.
No, they're Mick's. I'm helping him unload.
How are Mick and Alita?
Fine.
Will you say hello to them for me?
I'll be right back. They're doing some Christmas shopping.
Here's a medium-sized fir, Mrs. Scott. Or maybe you'd rather have a spruce.
A silver-tipped spruce?
Oh, I've got a beauty.
You remembered. Oh, Carrie.
Ron! Ron! Mick and Alita sent me to get you. Oh, I didn't know you had a customer.
How about this one, Mrs. Scott?
No, send this one to me.
There's so much happening in this film, Stephen. The overbearing expectations of one's own family, the suffocation of being part of the American class system, and the loneliness that can so often come with Christmas. Before we get into that, though, perhaps just take us through the plot of what's happening in All That Heaven Allows.
Well, look, you've got Jane Wyman's character and she is a recent widow. And so she's kind of facing that Christmas, you know, alone. And then there is kind of a recurring theme in Christmas films is that it can actually be quite a difficult time. But what happens is she kind of stumbles across her gardener. And it's kind of one of those stereotypical, you know, rich lady falls for the gardener. But it's actually presented in quite a wholesome way until we start to see society's expectations. So she's quite fine with having a romance that's perhaps below her station. But where it gets problematic is when all of her best friends get involved and they're all quite catty at Christmas party. And then both of her adult children who are still mooching around the house, it should be said, so perhaps aren't in a great position to have an opinion, but they're really against.
And what is right for her and what she wants isn't really part of the equation at all.
Exactly. And so well, on the surface, it kind of looks like a nice, gentle Love Actually style rom-com at Christmas. It's actually a really biting social satire and it's taking a swipe at the American class system. And of course, both America and Australia like to fool themselves that they're not really a class-based society like Britain, but of course they are. And this film in the 1950s is showing that that was a problem. The director's really taking a bit of a stand against that.
My favourite moment in the film is where Jane Wyman's character is presented with a television set by her children as a Christmas gift. But it could also be construed as an attack on the emerging medium of television here. Douglas Sirk, the director, frames the character's reaction via her reflection in the TV screen. So she stares at the thoughtless gift that's presented to her, intended to provide the company that she needs in the absence of her dead husband. But of course, all she sees is the reflection of her own loneliness.
Mother, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Mrs. Scott. And Happy New Year.
Kay and I couldn't afford anything but a table model, but it's got a nice size screen and it's easy to operate.
All you have to do is turn that dial and you have all the company you want right there on the screen. Drama, comedy,
life's parade at your fingertips.
That scene is really interesting because I guess another recurring theme about Christmas is over-commercialization. And so what you've got is her two children who have such beef with her settling for this man who they see as below her, but meanwhile they have no interest whatsoever in sharing time with their mother at Christmas and go so far as to give her this really thoughtless present, you know, just if you buy someone something that can entertain them.
Like, okay, that's it, dust my hands off. But it's not presented in a way that suggests that her children are bad people. They've just been brought up with a little bit too much comfort, and perhaps it's only now when the stakes have become so high for Carrie's happiness that she's starting to realise just what the American society that she's brought them up in has really done to them.
And it's that message again that we should think of others at this time of year and step a little outside of our own bubble.
Well, Douglas Sirk is actually a very interesting person in that regard because, of course, he was actually German. He was born Hans Detlef Sirk, and he began his career over in Germany in the mid-1930s. But it was after marrying a Jewish woman that he left the country for obvious reasons in 1937, settling in what we'd all call the land of hope and dreams of 1950s Hollywood, where it's always sunny. And it was really the frustration that he felt at the darker undercurrent of American prejudices that became an enormous influence on the remainder of his career, clearly evident in many of his other works. Part of the genius, Stephen, I would say, behind Sirk's work, all of his films really, they have this devastatingly beautiful visual appeal, and they're very, very striking in their colour scheme, the lush orchestral soundtracks. He gave this impression of a very big budget Hollywood epic. And yet, like the suburbia that he depicts in those films, there was always much more happening behind that facade. And All That Heaven Allows is really quite a savage attack on the American values of the time. But as a director, he was incredibly clever to do this because in his time, he was very much passed off as being just a director of what they'd call women's films.
As I said, it could be seen as a rom-com if you take it at very surface level. I mean, he really is satirising, you know, all of those expectations and the way that people are seen to be and the way they actually are. The character really, Carrie, really does have to question the entire way she's been brought up to believe. I mean, there's a line she says very near the end about how long it takes you to realise how important it is to live your life for you and to not worry about the detractors.
Stephen, there are two other films that really stand out for me at this time of year. And interestingly, they both star Barbara Stanwyck. One of them was the 1940 sentimental gem, Remember the Night.
Sorry about the present situation. I fell up.
There's some other packages over there. See who they're for.
Lee? Oh, well, wow. She can always depend on Santa Claus, huh? Merry Christmas.
Oh, no. You shouldn't have gone to all this trouble.
Go on, open them up right now.
Oh, thank you. It's so pretty.
Oh, it's really nothing at all, just made from some scraps and things that I've accumulated through the years.
Well, it's lovely. Oh.
Aunt Ella?
Uh-huh.
There's something so fascinating with the way Barbara Stanwyck comes across on screen, and this film is certainly no different. Now, here she plays a shoplifter who tends to punch above her weight, probably a little bit too much, and is caught just before Christmas. The lawyer acting against her, played by Stanwyck's Double Indemnity co-star Fred McMurray, feels sorry for her and arranges for her to be let out on bail. Though a series of mishaps and coincidences happen, and she eventually finds herself spending Christmas with his family. Now, Remember the Night is definitely high on sweet sentimentality. It was written by Preston Sturges, his final effort purely as a writer before switching to director. Stephen, I found it incredibly warm and quite perfect for this time of year, but I know that you have less of a stomach for what we call sugary schmaltz. Do you not think that festive films can take a little bit more sentimental license, though?
Of course they do. And actually, again, this is really interesting because that's a bit of a recurring theme, the shoplifting at Christmas. And so I do wonder if this is, again, some commentary on the commercialization of the season. But even this year, the new Christmas film starring Diane Keaton and John Goodman, Love the Coopers.
Oh, yes.
Marissa Tomei plays Diane Keaton's sister, and Anthony Mackie is the mall cop who picks her up because she is so kind of, I guess, disassociated from her family, and she feels that she has to buy something expensive to fit in. She shoplifts, and they're kind of, her and Anthony Mackie's storyline is essentially her in the back of the car as they two bond, and he decides not to, you know, deliver her to the police station. So yeah, there's definitely something here about what does Christmas truly mean.
Well, the other Barbara Stanwyck film I wanted to mention takes a bit of a different approach. It's 1945's Christmas in Connecticut.
Who said there isn't any Santa Claus? Look what I found in my stocking. Don't you come near me, you sea wolf. After the way you've deceived me,
I
warn you, if you take another step, I'll scream.
If you've just eaten a whole turkey and you've got a few people strewn across your living room, maybe you just want something that you won't really have to think about. A lazy, easy, fun film. I think it's fair to say that Christmas in Connecticut certainly is that kind of film. It is important just to have some fun, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly another great Christmas tradition of the screwball farce. And this is, you know, one of those examples of relatively small lies snowballing and you know, the hoops that these people have to jump through when the main character, you know, is supposed to have this cozy little Connecticut farm, and that's her, you know, newspaper column. But in actual fact, she's based in Manhattan, I believe, and suddenly finds herself attempting to marry someone in Connecticut so that she can use their farm, so that she can pretend she has a child and not get fired by her publisher, who has decided that they're going to have Christmas on the farm she's written so much about but hasn't actually completely fabricated.
So I love the moments in this film featuring Barbara Stanwyck trying to come across as a maternal mother and repeatedly referring to her baby as an it.
They can't even keep the babies straight. I mean, there's at least, I think, as far as I recall, there's two different babies that kind of get roped into this role.
Well, still to come on this special Christmas Day edition of The Cinema Show, we'll look at the darkness behind some of our festive favourites, plus a special word from Santa himself. Yes, you heard right. Stay tuned.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
You're back with The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. Let's consider two slightly more recent films that have become staples around this time of year. One is from the 1980s and the other from 2003, and I know that you have very differing opinions on both of these films. First up, this one's your pick, Gremlins.
Look, I did acknowledge that this is a slightly weird one, but it is the one that I find myself going back to year after year. And while, again, on the surface, it seems like a, you know, dark horror for children in a kind of Brothers Grimm, Roald Dahl, gone wild way, it's still essentially at its heart a very Christmas film. You know, Mogwai, he's the inappropriate gift given to the young boy and, of course, spills water on him and then it sets off this rampage. But around all of that, there's all these little messages that recur over and over in Christmas films, you know. The gremlins shoot a poor, lonely granny who's, you know, spending the season on her own up the stairlift and through the roof, which, you know, doesn't end well. But there's that theme of loneliness at Christmas and families coming together, and it just so happens that they're facing a rampage of little demons this Christmas. But it brings them all together in the end.
That's the important thing. Now, we are in London, so we couldn't discuss Christmas without mentioning 2003's Love Actually. Stephen, this isn't what one might call a great film.
I can certainly see from an outside perspective that it is. You know, it has a certain Christmas hysteria to it. People love this film. I think it's probably got a lot to do with Hugh Grant. He kind of epitomizes Christmas for me. He's that, you know, foppish kind of unreal representation of what the perfect Englishman is. Mm. And so in the way that those 1940s and 50s American films were, you know, presenting that idyllic Christmas life that we all aspired to. I think Hugh Grant kind of taps into a certain British aspect of that. This idea of the sentimentalised Britain, that does fit well at Christmas.
And here is, of course, also in Bridget Jones's Diary, which is another Christmas favourite.
Much better, actually. I love that film.
Most definitely. I love that film. It's funny, it's not really considered a Christmas film, though, even though it very much is, especially with that lovely sweater that Colin Firth, of course, turns up in. And people around the world were looking at that sweater and just thinking, oh, isn't it absolutely hilarious? Colin Firth is wearing a Christmas sweater. What a hideous jumper. Until, of course, well, as an Australian, I arrive here in London and realise, oh my God, everyone's wearing them.
They all are. It's insane. Like, literally, I was like, is this some mass, kind of flash mob? I don't know, but everyone in London is wearing a Christmas sweater. He's obviously started a craze.
Well, Hugh Grant is probably just as Christmassy, as you say, as the Christmas sweater, at least for British people. Perhaps there will be a time when there are a tradition of putting Hugh Grant up on top of your Christmas tree. We may get to that point. You never know. But of all the films we've discussed today, there's one character we haven't spent too much time on. And I want to get to him now because I feel he's been sadly neglected, as he was very sadly neglected in a very, very classic film, Miracle on 34th Street. His name, of course, is Santa Claus. So what does the big man himself think of the many times he's been portrayed in various films? Well, we asked him.
One of the first films to chronicle my Christmas Eve ritual was simply titled The Visit from Santa Claus. It's a silent film from 1899, and it only runs for about just over a minute. It was made by Mr. George Albert Smith, who, if I recall correctly, was a hypnotist and alleged psychic. Aside from all that hocus-pocus, however, he was also an important pioneer of film's early days, having developed the first successful color film process. Some years later, in 1907, a charming film emerged called A Little Girl Who Did Not Believe in Santa Claus. It recounts the story of a young boy who happens upon a girl outside in the snow, and she's shivering because her family can't afford a coat for her. Feeling sorry for her, he invites her into his home, and they play for a while and read stories. The girl tells him that she doesn't believe in Father Christmas because he's never visited her before, which prompts the boy to find a way to bring Christmas to the poor young girl. I must say, his method of trapping Santa with a rope and holding him at gunpoint, it's rather drastic. But it does serve as a reminder that for all the children I can't visit every Christmas, it's up to everyone else to ensure they're cared for. Another charming classic, of course, is A Christmas Carol. Charles Dickens wrote that one way back in 1843, and it actually features an early version of a character based on me in the form of the Ghost of Christmas Present. In the book, he's described as a large man with a red beard and a fur-lined green robe. It's been adapted to films many times, the first being in 1901. But the first time the story was told on the screen, the sound, was in 1935's Scrooge, made right here in London. For whatever reason, MGM felt the need to do it all over again just three or so years later. That version, using the original title, opened at New York City's Radio Music Hall, where it didn't break any records, but did reasonably well. It did, however, feature some marvelous music by the wonderful composer Franz Waxman. Of course, one of the world's favorite depictions of me is, no doubt, 1947's Miracle on 34th Street, starring a very young Natalie Wood. That film has become so much a part of the festive season that it's helped make Macy's department store part of the traditional American Christmas. You can still visit part of the Macy's original window display celebrating the film outside its Santaland every year. Among the more bizarre films to feature my likeness has to be the science fiction comedy from 1964, Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. Now, the story here has something to do with Martians kidnapping Santa and taking him back to Mars because apparently there's no one in Mars to hand out Christmas gifts. It's often voted one of the worst films ever made, though I can't imagine why. There was also an attempt at telling my life story in 1985 with the film simply titled Santa Claus. I thought the way they animated the reindeer using puppets was very clever, and Dudley Moore was splendid. Though I wasn't so sure about the evil John Lithgow and those candies that make you fly. And another picture that's become an annual classic is, of course, Tim Burton's wonderful 1993 film, The Nightmare Before Christmas. So you see, my time in the cinema stretches from the earliest silent films to the pictures of today. I couldn't possibly pick a favorite. So, in the words of one Mr. Jack Skellington, or was it Charles Dickens? I don't even remember. Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night.
That was Santa Claus himself looking back at his many depictions across the world of cinema. Now, Stephen, as we mentioned, MUBI's Christmas present for us all this year is the pinnacle of festive films. It's A Wonderful Life.
Mary, I know what I'm going to do tomorrow and the next day and next year and the year after that. I'm shaking the dust of this crummy little town off my feet and I'm going to see the world. Italy, Greece, the Parthenon, the Colosseum. Then I'm coming back here and go to college and see what they know. And then I'm going to build things. I'm going to build airfields. I'm going to build skyscrapers 100 stories high. I'm going to build bridges a mile long. Were you going to throw a rock? Hey, that's pretty good. What'd you wish, Mary?
Buffalo gals, can't you come out tonight? Can't you come out tonight? Can't you come out tonight? Buffalo gals, can't you come out tonight?
Dance by the light of the moon. What'd you wish when you threw that rock?
Oh, no.
Come on, tell me.
If I told you, it might not come through.
What is it you want, Barry? What do you want? You want the moon? Just say the word and I'll throw a lasso around it and pull it down. Hey, that's a pretty good idea. I'll give you the moon, Mary.
I'll take it.
There's a certain element of darkness that permeates the atmosphere, isn't there?
Yeah. When you sort of step back from the plots that are at their surface quite, you know, schmaltzy and lovely and Christmas is great and we all come together, the whole storyline of It's a Wonderful Life is sort of a sliding doors story. You have the hero essentially, you know, about to jump off a bridge at the start and he thinks he's got nothing to live for and he's all alone. And then in a kind of, I guess, the way Scrooge is shown in A Christmas Carol, you know, what life might be like if you let yourself into Tiny Tim's family, you know. So there is this strange, dark undercurrent. And I guess it's a real reminder that at this time of year, it can be really lonely and it can be quite confronting when you find yourself at the end of the year and everyone's happy families if things haven't gone quite right for you.
So many films that just don't get the Christmas spirit at all, the way that I would see it anyway. They're films that carry with it an insistence that you must be happy at Christmas, that you must enjoy it. There are these certain things that you absolutely must do in order to pass the Christmas test. As you say, Christmas is not always a happy time for everyone, and it's very important not to just make sure that you're enjoying it. You need to try and ensure that you're spreading that as well.
Yeah, and I think almost all of these films have that message at their heart, is that Christmas isn't about the presents, it's not about the house, it's not about your social standing, it's about sharing it with each other, however modest that may be.
Well, on that note, it does bring us to the end of our very special Christmas Day edition of The Cinema Show. A very special thank you to my festive guest, Stephen A. Russell, joining us all the way from Melbourne in Australia and probably just as far away, Santa Claus. Now, listen again and find out more at monocle.com or subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or SoundCloud. You can always get in touch with me by sending me an email, br@monocle.com. The Cinema Show returns next week. Until then, I'm Ben Ryland. Happy Christmas and thanks for listening.